Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins here with my co-host. Let's start with Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gelt.
Hey there, everybody. How you doing?
And we have Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds.
Hey, everyone. Hope you're having a great holiday season.
And of course, we can't forget the one and only Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart.
Hello. How are you?
We are out, but guess what? That doesn't mean we're leaving you without any audio. As a podcast that has well over 120 episodes so far. Well, actually, I take that back. Almost 120 episodes.
Be optimistic.
So far. Yes, we found the three of them that we think are wonderful, and we're playing them. We're playing one of those today while we're off playing in the snow. Linda, you're playing in the snow out there in the desert, right?
I am.
Yes, absolutely. So happy holidays to everyone, and we'll see you again back here in January.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Thanks for tuning in to the Money Tree Podcast, your source for investing and money matters. I'm your host, Andrea Trevelyan from TakeASmartStep.com. This week, we're going to look at the rent versus buy debate with soon-to-be CFP Jason Hull. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Trading involves risk of loss and is not appropriate for everyone.
We've never met, but I know a secret about you, something your own mother doesn't know. I know the number one profit-killing mistake you're currently making with your trading. Hi, I'm Bill Polis, and I created an unusual 15-second quiz that can pinpoint and eliminate your number one mistake so you can potentially risk as little as $25 to make $100. Find out how at MoneyQuiz101.com. For the next few days, it's free. Just go to MoneyQuiz101.com. That's MoneyQuiz101.com.
Today's guest is Jason Hull. He is a CFP candidate and runs Hull Financial Planning. Prior to starting Hull Financial Planning, he was co-founder of Open Source Connections and sold it in 2012. He also served in the Army as an armor officer and served two tours in Bosnia with NATO. He holds an MBA from the University of Virginia Darden Graduate School of Business and a BS from the United States Military Academy at West Point. Jason, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me, Andrew.
Before we get into kind of all the pros and cons, I would love it if you would just tell everybody a little bit about yourself and then your history with real estate.
So a little bit about myself, besides being a massive soccer fan and a dog lover, I am a financial planner. I am going to be a CFP in the next month or so from the time that this podcast comes out. I passed my CFP exam back in 2012. I co-founded, ran, and then sold a software company. I have my master's from the University of Virginia, MBA, and I went to West Point for undergrad. So I was in the Army for 5 years, drove tanks. Ran stuff over, shot stuff, got to go see all sorts of interesting destroyed places in the world. And as it relates to this podcast, I have owned, I have rented, I am a landlord, I am a renter currently. I have done spec houses to try and flip. I have invested in land to try and flip. So I have seen the whole gamut of single family homes and living situations. The only real estate investment I've never taken part in is a commercial real estate investment.
And do you ever have any desire to do that?
Probably not. And I think that's just because of the time frame that we're looking at before we retire. I think if I had a 10-year time horizon still, I might buy a tranche of a development project. And certainly, and I think this is true everywhere. If you can get in with a really good developer, a really good financing company, I know this is true in like Portland and Seattle. It's true in Dallas. There are good opportunities. Obviously, your mileage may vary, but that is a viable way to get involved in real estate investing if you are an accredited investor. But given our time frame, it's not something that we're looking at.
Okay, great. Well, what I actually want to start with, because this will kind of help guide the rest of our conversation, I think, is right now you're renting, but you're actually a landlord, too, because you own rental properties. Why did you decide to become a renter?
So I wrote about this on a blog called controlyourcash.com. It's called Why You Can Both a Landlord and a Renter Be. So if you want to read all the guts and gore and details, you can go find it there. But we owned a house, and we also at that point own probably 6 or 7 rental properties. We're now up to 11 doors, and we own them all free and clear. That's something that in general, I prefer at least my clients pay for their investment properties in cash. But we were driving up to Fort Worth every single weekend. The market had kind of hit a local peak. So real estate is very local. You know, what is hot in a suburb may not be hot in downtown, may not be hot in another suburb. It completely depends on what is happening in that very local economy. And our housing market had significantly jumped. And so we asked our realtor how much she could sell our house for. And she gave us a number that was a little bit higher than I expected. And we figured that we could actually sell that house, buy 2 investment properties, and then use the cash flow from those 2 investment properties to pay for an apartment in downtown Fort Worth, where we would be living right in amongst all the mixed use community activities. It's right near an enormous trail system by the Trinity River. There are a lot of restaurants. There was a gym. It was a quality of life decision for us that we could have as a financial break even by selling our house and renting. So the numbers were almost exactly the same for renting as they were for owning. And it was a location that we wanted to be in. And so for us, it was a lifestyle choice that was backed up by the numbers.
Fabulous. I love that it was a lifestyle choice, because I believe that's kind of what housing comes down to. So let's get into what the benefits are. Let's start with the buy side. What are the benefits of owning a home?
Well, so let me back up to what you said about housing as a lifestyle choice. It is a lifestyle choice and a financial choice. So you will have to pay for the lifestyle that you choose. And so this is kind of where we get into the buy versus rent decision. The biggest mistake that people make when they purchase a house is getting emotionally invested in it and then thinking that because of their emotions, that house is going to be the greatest investment that they've ever had. So, you know, if you listen to what the National Association of Realtors tells you, they're going to tell you that your house is your biggest investment. Well, that's caca. It's not an investment. It is a place to live. Yeah. And it is a representation of some sort of cash flow. Either you're going to pay for your house in cash, which is a representation of the opportunity cost of what you could put that money to use for, or it's going to be a mortgage payment. So the benefits, I think there are, one is the tax code is obviously in favor of home ownership. You can get a mortgage interest deduction. The failing that people have when calculating the value of that mortgage interest deduction is that they forget to take into account the standard deduction. So a mortgage interest deduction is only good in as much as it gets you above and beyond the standard deduction. So if you don't donate to charities, if you're not contributing to your IRAs, et cetera, anything that doesn't get you above that standard deduction threshold, then the mortgage interest deduction is nullified. So if you have a mortgage and you're still under the standard deduction, you're not getting a mortgage interest deduction. But if you have student loan interest that you're paying off, or you know, anything that gets you above that deduction threshold, and this is one of those, go see your tax advisor. I am not a CPA. CFPs and CPAs are not the same thing. Then if you're above that standard deduction line, then it's a positive benefit. I mean, let's say your effective tax rate is 28%. If you're paying $10,000 that first year in mortgage interest, then you're effectively only paying $7,200. That is not to say that may be the best deal for you, because you're still paying interest to a bank. But with low interest rates, it's not a financially bad deal. I'm not a huge fan of debt, but it is a good one. The second benefit is it's a forced savings program. And so what do I mean by that? I mean, if you're going to hold a property for 30 years, then you are effectively forcing yourself at whatever your mortgage interest rate is to save money. Again, not the best savings program in the world. I'm not a huge fan of that, but it is kind of a beneficial byproduct. It does have psychological benefits. There are a lot of psychological benefits of being able to customize the place that you live in, of kind of nesting, if you will, mm-hmm. of saying, this is my home. The problem that comes up, it's twofold. One is in the purchase. You walk through a house and you start imagining yourself living there and you get emotionally attached to it. And therefore, you're willing to pay more for that property than you might have otherwise paid for it because you get emotionally invested. And the second is another psychological phenomenon that basically, once you call something yours, you think it is more valuable than anyone else will. So there was an experiment that Dan Ariely out of Duke did where he gave students a mug and he said, this is your mug. How much do you think this mug is worth? Then he had other students say, how much would you be willing to pay for that mug? And it's just a plain mug, nothing special to it. And the students that were told, this is your mug, wound up overvaluing by some extraordinary amount the value of that mug. And so what happens is as a homeowner versus as a house owner, you, because you've got, this is where your kids grew up and this is where your husband told that really funny joke in front of the fireplace and you've got all these memories and the dog found his first rabbit in the backyard, et cetera, you think that the house is worth more than anyone else in the market thinks that house is worth. And so when it comes time to sell that house, you make it more difficult to sell the house because you're putting out the signal with a high price that your realtor, or if you're doing it yourself, you have to fight the market against that. So there's a lot of psychology that happens. So you have to separate the emotional piece of the joy that you get out of a house versus the financial value that is associated with that house. And there are also studies that show that we are much happier purchasing experiences than we are purchasing stuff. And I think people kind of conflate the two. Mm-hmm. And so they think, I'm going to buy this house. I'm going to decorate it. I'm going to fill it full of my knickknacks. And that's going to be what makes me happy. And that's not psychologically going to be what makes you happy. The other benefit is usually, and this is a very, very broad brush statement, the best school districts are where there is strong home ownership as opposed to rent. So it's usually more difficult to find a good school district if you're renting. So if you have kids, you have the ability to control where your kids are going to go to school by the place that you purchase. Of course, there's probably going to be a premium to that. But if you're renting, even if you're renting a house, you are subject to the landlord's whims, that the landlord could say, hey, I'm going to jack the prices up by $500 a month. And suddenly it's no longer economically feasible for you to be in that house. So you do get to control that variable. And a lot of people, as they get older, are happier if they're able to age in place as opposed to living in a nursing facility. If they are able to get skilled nursing care at home, they're happier as they age in place. And now there's some contradictory recently researched evidence by Michael Finca out of Texas Tech that shows that retirees are happier when they move. But if you're moving to your final house, then if it is one that is accessible and that you don't have to move from and you can get skilled nursing care at home, you're going to be happier in that place as opposed to moving into a nursing facility.
Okay, great. I thought I was the only person who ever referred to owning a home as a forced savings plan. So I like to hear that you say that because that's what it is. It's forcing you to save.
Yeah. But the thing is, don't count on appreciation. I think that's a mistake that house owners and also investors make, is counting on appreciation. They think, oh, real estate can only go up. And that's not true. We saw that in 2008, which provided a great opportunity for investors like me to take advantage of the psychological failings of other people. It was great for investors, but horrible for the average homeowner.
Yeah, and that's a good point. The other point with that is, even in a good market, most markets that aren't, you know, your hot spike markets or, you know, have some other factor in them, they're only appreciating at inflation anyway.
Yeah. The real return of real estate is right at inflation. So Robert Shiller, the Nobel Prize winner, has done a ton of research on this. And yeah, real estate only appreciates over time at the value of inflation. So the real return is 0%. Where you make your money on real estate is at the purchase. And the good thing about buying a house that is different than renting an apartment is you can take advantage of both an inefficient market and a psychologically driven market. And so stocks, and I know you have a value investor on your round table, stocks are driven by an efficient market, but an irrational market. So people will buy in waves. They follow the herd. Real estate is both an inefficient market and a psychologically driven market. So you have people that are emotional about their house sales and purchases. And also you have a market where there's imperfect information. So there's a whole industry called shadow listings. There's probably about 25% of the actual inventory of real estate that's available. You have people so those are not on MLS. They're not going to be on Zillow. They're going to be because I called up my realtor and said, hey, I'm looking to get rid of this property. Can you shop it around? Can you call your buddies and see who could buy and do a quick close? So there is an opportunity if you have a very good, well-connected realtor who has a lot of weak connections, to purchase a property below market value and get it on sale. Or if you're willing to go through this where people have bought too much property, they had too much debt, they got foreclosed on, or they're about to get foreclosed on, or grandma stayed in the house for 70 years and she never updated the place. And then she passed away and the kids are left with this house full of crap that they don't want to deal with. And so they just want to get rid of it. They live five states over. They don't want to fool with it. If you can go to the estate sale and go, hey, I will write you a check for $25,000 for this house and I'll close tomorrow. There is a great opportunity to purchase homes for sale. There's also a great opportunity if you're handy to improve the value of your home. So if you're the type that loves to take a sledgehammer to drywall and you like to add on and make a pretty garden and do an addition and you're good at it, that's where you can create financial value that the average person is not going to be able to create and that you won't have the opportunity to do when renting a property.
True. Very true. So let's go into the downside of the house, because as we're talking about purchase price and everything, there is a financial downside to owning. So what are the key downsides?
The biggest one that people fail to account for is maintenance costs.
Yeah.
And so the rough rule of thumb that I give to my clients is 1% of the current market value of the home is what you need to be putting aside every year for deferred maintenance. So eventually your roof is going to need repairing. Eventually, you might have to do foundation work because there's 24 inches worth of rain in a 1 month period. Not that I know anything about that happening to my properties this past month. So even if you don't spend the money, you need to put it aside in a kitty. And I think a lot of people don't do that. And then all of a sudden the roof starts leaking and they have the OSM, the oh crap moment. Mm-hmm. And they wind up taking out a home equity line of credit to pay for that roof, which if they would have just thought ahead, they wouldn't have to do. But they don't account for all of the other costs. If you have an alarm system, if you have the lawn guy, if mm-hmm. you, if you buy a big house, big houses need more in utilities. So I think there are a lot of costs that are foreseeable, but that people turn a blind eye to. They only think about their mortgage payment as opposed to PITI.
Right. Yeah.
The other one is, for a lot of counties, property taxes are a huge driver of their revenues. And so any chance that they get to either jack up the rate or jack up the valuation, they're going to do it. And so if you're not on top of that, you may wind up paying 25-50% more a couple of years down the road in property taxes, or you're going to have to spend a lot of time with the assessor justifying why your property is not as valuable as the tax assessor thinks it is.
Right.
So there's a lot of costs that people just disregard beyond the mortgage payment that wind up making the overall total cost of ownership of a home more expensive. Obviously, the implied cost of interest, that's money that you're giving to a bank. There's closing costs, both on the purchase side and on the sale side.
Mm-hmm.
And people move a lot more often than they think they're going to move.
Yes.
So I think the average, and I'd have to look up the numbers, I think the average length of home ownership is about 7 years. And so you're effectively, if you own a home for 6 years and you sell the property and you use a realtor, then that's 1% per year, roughly, because it does compound, that you're having to pay to amortize to cover for that realtor's commission. Then you have the moving costs, you have the make-ready costs, you have all the repair costs for where the dog chewed up the carpet, things like that, that when you're living there, you don't care about, but when you move, that you have to take care of. And the other one, and this is something that I don't think a lot of people actually think about, is mobility. So
Right. If
you just purchased a home and your wife gets this kick butt job offer across the country, you are much less likely to move for that kick butt job offer. If you just got a mortgage and now you're looking at having to sell the property, there was a study that basically showed that people who either have paid off their homes or are not underwater, you know, have significant equity in their homes, or who rent, have higher incomes over the lifespan of their careers because they're willing to move to where the jobs are.
Interesting.
And so if you own a home, especially if you overpaid for it or you got too much of a mortgage, you are much less likely to move. And employers, and this is kind of one of those John Nash game theory things. If an employer knows that you're stuck and you can't move, then they can offer you lower wages because what's your threat? You're not going to move. You're not going to go find another job somewhere else. So they can offer you lower wages. So it works against you. If you have too much home and you don't have that flexibility to move for your career.
That makes sense completely. That's my biggest downfall, or what I consider one of the bigger downfalls, is definitely the maintenance costs, but only a very slightly further ahead of you all of a sudden don't have any liquidity in your moving costs, your home, et cetera.
Yeah.
So
there's a whole reason there's a phrase called house rich, cash poor.
Right. Exactly. So are there any other like big downsides that you don't think a lot of people think about?
The neighborhood that you move into is not going to be the same neighborhood 5 years down the road.
Oh, you can say that one again.
you are really, really subject to the whims of who the people are that are right around you. And that really affects your quality, the quality of your experience. If you have great neighbors and they're there, they have young kids, you have young kids, you're not going to move for the next 15 years because they're all going to go through school together and you have your little cul-de-sac barbecues and everything, you're going to have a great experience. If a wave of foreclosures goes through your neighborhood and all of a sudden it goes from 95% home ownership to 60% home ownership, and your next door neighbor gets foreclosed on, and then there's a renter, and then the renter moves out, and then there's another renter, and they chew through your fence, et cetera, you're going to have a miserable time. And so it truly is a microeconomy. You could be in a bad neighborhood with a group of great neighbors around you, and so you don't care. You have a good time. You like everyone around you. So you are subject more so than when you rent, I think you're subject to the whims of those that are right around you. And kind of the macro microeconomics of your subdivision.
Right. Okay. Great. Well, then let's talk a little bit about how do you figure out what's right for you? So I'm just deciding whether I should buy or not. What should I consider to make that decision?
So if this is your first kind of out of college or moving into a new city, something like that, I always recommend that you rent for at least a year, no matter what, because you don't know the neighborhoods. You don't know the area. You don't know what it's like to own a home. You don't know how steady your job is, what the economics are. If you have a job and you rent, you have a one-year lease, sometimes even a shorter lease. Ours has been 9-month periods where we live in Fort Worth. And if things go south, well, you only have to suck it down for the length of your lease, and then you can change your situation. But then once you kind of know the neighborhoods and know what you're looking for, know your job prospects, it is a combination of a financial decision, which never listen to a realtor for how much house you can afford.
Or a banker,
right. Go get a financial planner. I know a great financial planner who can help you out with that. but it's a financial decision first and foremost. But the finances, just because it's a good financial decision doesn't mean it's going to be a good emotional decision. And this is where you really have to canvas, what sort of lifestyle do I want? What am I going to do on the weekends? Who are the people that are going to be around me? If I have kids, are there lots of kids? If I have dogs, are there lots of dogs? Do people just keep their dogs tied up in the yard and never let them out, never take them for a walk? You know, you have to match your lifestyle with the lifestyle of the neighborhood that you're going to move into. You can't buy more house than you can afford. But at the same time, just because you can afford a house doesn't mean that you should buy the house that you can afford. Because if you wind up in a neighborhood where there's not that emotional, spiritual connection that aligns with what you think is important in life and geographically is close to the stuff you want to do, or alternatively, you want your back 40 and you don't want anyone around you. What's the zoning? Can someone plop up a trailer home park in the lot next to you? So it's a lot of research that you have to do. I mean, basically that year that you're renting, you should be researching every weekend to determine what is the neighborhood that I truly want. And then once you find that neighborhood that you truly want, and preferably the street and probably the block of houses, then you watch it like a hawk and you try and identify, is there someone in that little section who is going to wind up making a poor decision for them that provides me with the opportunity to buy that house on sale? Mm-hmm. So it's not... Usually it's not a decision that is quickly made. The other thing that really, really helps is having a very large stockpile of cash so that you have more negotiating leverage. So if you're able to say, hey, look, I'm pre-approved. I am pre-approved for X, and X happens to be like 15% below the asking price, and that's all I can do. And you write a personal letter about something that's going to create some sort of emotional connection with the seller, then you have a better chance. If there's a house that you really, really want, write a letter to the seller. Like, write a personal letter to the seller. I know several people who have put in bids on homes where the bid was not the highest bid, but they wrote letters, and the letters were what convinced the seller to sell to them. Even though you're never going to see those people again, this is transactional. Your goal is to extract the most value out of it, because it's not like you're going to like invite them over to your house and say, hey, look at what I did to your old place. Don't you love the purple walls?
I have a friend who did that, and she included a family picture. Like, this is going to be our forever home. This is our family. This is what we're going to do. And they, like you said, they got it in a bidding war, even though they weren't the highest.
It's emotional. That's what I'm talking about. It's an irrational market. So yeah. If you can play on the emotions of the seller, then go for it. I mean, don't manipulate them, obviously. Don't be unethical. Don't lie. Like, I've got 13 children. You know, No. I can barely afford to feed them. Please help me. I can't afford this house. You know, don't lie. Don't be unethical. But if there's something that you can write that, that paints a picture of why you're really good people and why you will, you'll take care of this place. Because remember, these people, they feel a sense of ownership. And so they want to know, are the people who are going to come into my house, quote unquote, going to take care of it? I mean, heck, we drive by our old place, even though we didn't, you know, we didn't particularly have this emotional connection. We're curious, like, oh, were they able to keep the trees alive? Yeah, I mean, so we want to drive by. We're curious.
We would drive by a house that we owned for like 6 months. Yeah. We'd drive by it.
Yeah, like, how's the neighborhood change? Yeah. Yeah, you're curious. So anything that can play onto the emotional aspect of the people who feel like, for whatever reason, that house is a legacy of theirs, play on it.
Excellent. All right, so just to kind of wrap things up here, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you think is really important to somebody considering whether to buy or rent or anything like that?
Don't buy into the idea that owning a home is the American dream, or that you're a less successful person if you rent, or that renting a property only means that you're going to be stuck with a whole bunch of noisy partying college kids if that's not what you're looking for. I'm a big fan of renting. I like the idea of the mobility that it gives you. You know exactly what your costs are going to be for the next year. You can theoretically set aside the money that generates the cash flow that then pays for the rental. When we need curtains hung, or when the garbage disposal stops working, we just go online and we tell the people that the garbage disposal doesn't work, and the magic maintenance fairy comes by and it works again.
I need a magic maintenance fairy.
Yeah. And so the magic maintenance fairy doesn't come to your house if you own a house. The magic yard fairy, you don't have to worry about the yard fairy. There is a value in not having to worry about those things and the time that you save. If you rent a house, you're going to be responsible for the yard maintenance. But if you live in an apartment, I don't have a yard. I don't have trees I have to water every 3 days to try and keep them alive, because the HOA covenants require that I have two trees alive in my front yard. I don't have to worry about the home maintenance. There's a lot of psychological benefits to not having those burdens. And also, it has forced us to downsize, which the more stuff you get rid of, the less psychological burden you have on yourself. So it's also freeing. It gives you a sense of freedom. So don't go in to this buy versus rent decision with a preordained notion that renting is bad, because renting is perfectly fine. And for some people, it's an awesome way to go. And I have several soon to be retiree clients whom I have told, get rid of your house and rent, because you will be so much happier.
Right. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time, Jason. If somebody wants to find you, where can they find you at?
Whole Financial Planning, www.wholefinancialplanning.com. If you Google Fort Worth Financial Planner, I'm the first one that comes up.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Andrea.
Now we're moving on to the panel discussion. This week on our panel, we have Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds and Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamins. How are we doing, guys?
Awesome.
All right. We have a wonderful topic that was requested by one of our amazing viewers today, the buy versus rent debate.
Woohoo.
Never heard of it.
All right. Now, I know we've touched on this before, but we're going to kind of circle back through some stuff in case people haven't heard our opinions before. We're going to start with Miranda.
Oh, gosh.
take the rest of the show, Miranda.
Because this will be so much fun.
We're starting with Miranda so I can go refresh my coffee cup. No,
oh, my gosh. Between last week's and this week, it's like everybody will be like, Miranda needs to shut up for the next 3 weeks.
Well, maybe next week we can get a nice, calm investing topic.
No, because I'm the one that's leading the discussion next week.
So campy.
It's going to be so sad.
Okay, so here's the first question. In your opinion, what is the biggest benefit to owning and what is the biggest downside to owning a home?
Yeah, so the biggest benefit to owning a home is really the forced savings when you think about it. If you're going to be in it for a long time and you make your payments, you build up the equity, and then you have a large chunk of capital at the end, if you decide you want to sell your home, then it can give you a chunk of capital that you can use on something else or to buy a smaller home if you want to downsize during retirement. It also gives you a chance to tap into the equity of your home later. It's more of a forced savings thing. The biggest downside has to do with how much it costs, because the reality of the situation is that, you know, everybody's like, oh, well, it's going to appreciate in value. Well, unless you're living somewhere that you bought your house 30 years ago in like California or something, the big appreciation you're going to see is not going to be that big. For most people who live in the middle of the country, the appreciation is not that big, and it's probably going to be overwhelmed by the fact that you're paying interest and you're paying property taxes and you're paying for maintenance and repairs and for upkeep, and all of that stuff is money you're spending. And even if you take a tax deduction for some of those costs, like the interest costs and the property tax costs, even if you take a tax benefit for that, you're still probably going to be lucky to overall break even. So, you know, whatever. Let's move on to someone else.
Well, it kind of goes back to, you know, you're really only growing at inflation unless you are in one of those hot markets. So then right. Once you throw on top the costs, you know, like you said, you're maybe breaking even.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, if you're very lucky. Joe, what's your biggest benefit versus downside?
The biggest benefit depends on how you own the real estate. I think if you're buying it as an investment, real estate can be a pretty attractive investment, not just the appreciation on the property, but also tax deductions that you get.
I thought we were talking about buying a home and living it as a primary residence.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that, and I'm building up to that, is that if you own it as a rental property, if you own it as something else, that's fantastic. You know what the nice thing is of buying versus owning your own home, the one that you live in a nice place that you really like with neighbors that you like in a neighborhood that you like. It's a totally a lifestyle thing. It always drove me crazy when a client would say, well, you know, here's my retirement strategy. I'm saving into my house and then I'm going to sell it when I get ready for retirement. I'm like, really? You built all these dreams, all these things happen in this house. You have such an emotional attachment to it. And at retirement, you're going to just have to leave. You know how many people at 65 actually want to leave their house? Not a ton. I mean, some people do, but not everybody. So I'm not that excited about that. On the downside, obviously, is what you've already said. Cash flow is a huge drain on cash flow. I mean, you do things for your house that you wouldn't do for a rental house because you like living there. So you're going to do some fun stuff associated with quality of life that, you know, you wouldn't throw into a rental property.
Right, that's a great point too, is all of the things that you do to upgrade your home and make it a more pleasant living experience are not going to return for you dollar for dollar what you put into it. So that's something to keep in mind as well. The entire investment you are making in your primary residence that you buy to live in, they're all emotional investments. And like Joe said, it is a lifestyle choice. It is a lifestyle decision. It is about the lifestyle and being comfortable or not and building something you enjoy, but it's not like a financial investment that's going to give you financial returns.
Okay, so my biggest benefit is the lifestyle. So I think we're kind of all on that it's owning a home is a lifestyle decision. It's not an investing decision. So are we all agreed on that?
Yes.
I think it's fair.
Okay, so with that being said, if I'm going to go buy a house, and I know it's not an investment, I know it's a lifestyle and I'm buying for the right reasons, how do I know whether I should buy or rent? And then like, how does age impact that? How does, like, you know, Jason talked a lot about like, it gives you a lot less flexibility when you buy and everything. So knowing it's not an investment, it's a lifestyle, how do I decide? Joe?
Well, I like I like two things. Number one, start off with your long-term goals and make sure you can reach those first and still afford the house. Most people get so excited about the decision that's right in front of them right now, the house, that they just think about what the bank brings up, which is how big a loan can I get, right? The bank will completely overextend you if you let them. Even still today, they will let you take more money than you really should. Mm-hmm. So start with your long-term goals. Make sure you can easily afford those. You can afford to do the lifestyle things you like to do, and then make the house payment. Here's what I like to do to know whether my clients back in the day when I was an advisor could afford a house or not. We would set up a fund that's the difference between the amount they're paying in rent and the amount we think they're going to pay for their housing costs, not just the mortgage, but also the insurance. Jason talked about taxes, those types of things. And we would save that extra money into a fund. We'd have it like either direct deposit out of their paycheck if they could direct deposit to another place, or we would just have the additional money taken out once a month out of their you know, checking account to go into the special savings. And it could be, you know, the savings account could be anything. So the cool thing is they get this feeling of that money leaving the reservation. But if they get in trouble, the money's still theirs. So we would try that for 4 or 6 months to see how it felt not having that money in your pocket anymore, instead of just, you know, dreaming about it or looking at it on paper.
Interesting. So what if it was actually like the flip direction?
What do you mean the flip direction?
Like if it wasn't going to be a savings, or if it wasn't going to be an extra cost, or...
Oh, then if you like the property and you can handle your long-term goals, then do it.
Okay. So that was just if it was kind of pushing.
Yeah, because usually for most people, the decision is expense, right? I mean, the decision between renting and owning is expense. I've rarely seen somebody go buy a house that costs less than what it did to rent a place.
Okay. Is there any other decision factors you think, Joe?
The color. No, I don't know.
Don't buy brick.
If it has a purple door, stay away. Yeah.
You can always paint the door.
Oh, that's so pragmatic of you.
Okay, Miranda, what do you think you should do to determine if you should rent or buy?
Well, along with Joe, I think a lot of it has to do with your lifestyle decision and whether or not you can still meet your lifestyle goals. One of the reasons that I am a confirmed rent lover, I love renting, and I'm very sad that I will probably be swallowing my foot and sending it way down there when I make my move, my next move. But one of the reasons I love renting is because of my lifestyle. I like the idea of having maintenance people come and take care of everything. I like the community aspects of most apartment communities, where you have the clubhouse, you have the pool, you have the grilling areas that you can go have fun in. I like the compact nature of the apartments. I mean, I have a decent sized apartment right now. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath. It's got more than 1,300 square feet. And that's about all I need, really, for my son and I. I mean, we don't need something huge. And we don't really care for yard maintenance. And so something, you know, a condo maybe with a small back patio would be great. So it really, for me, for its lifestyle. And then if I want to move, I can. As Jason was talking about, it ties you down. You're stuck there. Right? If you buy something, it's harder to get rid of. And sometimes you have to get rid of it at a loss if you don't want to stick around and try and manage it as a rental. So I think it just really comes down to lifestyle, and can you meet your lifestyle goals? Be really clear about what you want and the things that you prefer, because my emphasis is on freedom and flexibility and convenience. Renting is a really good thing for me.
Yeah, I like where Miranda's starting from there, that it's not about like what the neighbors all think. It's she's looked inwardly to what's most important for her. And too many times I see people, especially people that are in their 20s, that think there's this mad rush. I got to buy a house. You know, I have to buy a house. I'll second and third what Miranda and Jason said. It so ties you down.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, we didn't actually buy our first house till we were 28. And that allowed us to do a lot of things, like save more for retirement. So then, like, as life started to happen, as you got older, we didn't have to save quite as much. And at the same time gave us that flexibility. So like a couple of things that I would recommend, especially to the younger people thinking about the whole buy versus rent thing is, you know, what are your jobs prospects? Especially if you're in your 20s and you're just getting started in your career, is buying a home going to kind of put a hamper on you if you can't get up and make a move really quick? And the other thing to consider is, you know, do you have a significant other? And if you do or don't, whatever, but if you go buy a house and then the next year fall in love and that person lives on the other side of town or they already have a house or they don't like the house that you're in, you know, you kind of want to think about those things as you're moving into older adult life, because you don't want to buy this great house and then have to turn around and sell it later.
Well, that's a great point, Andrea, because this is a long-term decision. If we look at most people take out a 30-year mortgage, and if you look at an amortization table, if you're actually going to get that really low interest rate that you're looking at right now on those loans, a 4.5% mortgage is not 4.5% if you only stay there for 4 years. And I'm looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics site right now that says that in 2014, the average person stayed at a job only 4.7 years if they're a man, 4.5 for women. So, and the number of people that stay in a job 10 years or more, only 30% of the working population. So there's a good chance you're going to be in a job 4 or 5 years, and you might have to relocate whether you want to or not. If you look at an amortization table over a 5 year period, all that money you're paying to your mortgage is going to the bank. Yep. The bank in an or amortization table, a lot of people don't know this, they get all their money up front, but your 4.5% mortgage is only 4.5% if you follow it through to the very end. You have to follow that all the way. Your interest rate gets better and better the longer you stay in that house. Mm-hmm. So you really need to make, if you're going to sign on the line for a 30-year mortgage, you want to be thinking 20, 30 years down the line. You don't want to think, well, I'm only going to be there 4 or 5 years, because then you really are flushing a lot of money down the toilet.
That's well, and you also have to think about stability too. And when I say stability, I mean like let's say you are now in your early 30s, and now you've got a family, and you like your job, and you like your city, and you're going to buy a home versus or looking at renting. Well, if you want to be in the good school district and you don't want to worry about your landlord selling or moving back into it, I've heard of that one a lot, you know, so they go off on assignment and turn their house into a rental because they want to come back. You know, buying might be better if you're ready for that stability and don't want to move away. Same thing as you get older. Like, I'm not set on staying in my house. I would actually prefer to downsize. But I can see how after I'm done gallivanting across the world, I would want my own place. So, you know, maybe once you hit 60, you're buying and not renting anymore.
It's funny how we're talking about this completely the opposite of the way that mortgage people talk about it. Mortgage people talk about renting as throwing money, you know, throwing money away. And we're talking about all the ways buying a house is throwing money away.
If you go back to, you know, we're talking about you might be getting inflation. Well, that means you're losing money. Like, let's take out all the expenses, like just pull all those out. Let's say your money is truly actually growing at inflation. You're not doing yourself any favors.
Right.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing is I really like this idea of buying when you know that you're going to be stable. And as Joe pointed out, when you're younger, you are more likely to be moving around. You're more likely to be job hopping, going someplace else. In my case, we bought when we were 27 and we stayed in the house for 7 years. So we did do that. But as Joe pointed out, most of that money, if you look at the amortization table, most of it went to the bank, right? For the interest. And by the time we actually were ready to sell, first of all, our home had dropped in value by about $12,000. And so when you looked at that, our home had dropped in value because of, you know, we bought just before the financial crisis, but just before all that stuff. And so our home had dropped in value by about $12,000. And with everything that we had done and all that we had paid, we had, like $8,000 maybe of equity in our home after paying on our mortgage for 7 years. So we ended up having to pay to unload the house. We had to pay money to get rid of the house.
That's so many
we
people.
Sold.
Yeah, that's so painful.
And that's just the way it is. And it's, you know, it's, we weren't upside down on our mortgage and we probably could have done a few things differently, but that's the reality of it. And you run that risk, especially if you're going to have to move less than 10 to 15. I mean, people are like, oh, well, if you're going to be in your house for 5 to 7 years, that's worth it. I say you need to be in there at least 10 to 15 years if you're going to make it worth it. And well, even then, it's questionable that it's worth it in terms of a financial investment. It's just maybe worth it for the emotional whatevers.
Well, yeah. And I think you kind of touched on something that a lot of people don't factor in when they're like, I'm going to go buy. They don't factor in all the selling costs. You know, it's not just I need closing costs to buy, but when you're the seller, you pay the rental, the realtor fees. So right. If you have a $100,000 house, you're looking at right around $6,000 just to get out of it, you know? So like you said, you had very minimal equity. Now all of a sudden you're paying fees on the back end too.
Isn't it funny how the real estate industry makes it real easy for you to get into a house, and then you're so passionate about getting out, they load it full of expenses and you don't care at that point. Like, no, I'm getting out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and that's where we were at. We were just like, no, we are done. Whatever it takes. It's going to take us 10,000. We're going to have to pay 10,000 of our own cash money. Okay. Get us out.
Another point that I don't think, kind of touching on what you were talking about, Joe, as far as like what the bank will lend you. I always recommend people ignore what the bank says, but instead of calculating, you know, your 28 to 32% on your gross, actually calculate that on your take home pay, because I don't know about you guys, but I have never ever lived on my gross income because Mr. Yeah. IRS man seems to keep finding me.
So annoying.
I know. What is he thinking? So if you are going to go buy, you know, do your own calculations. What is 30% of your take home pay? And that's what you should target for your total payment.
Well, and I like, as I mentioned earlier, I like going one better, which is look at, because for some people, they have so many things they want to do and they want to be so flexible with their lifestyle. That it might even be lower than that, you know.
That's us. We way underbuy every time we buy a house because I'd rather go on vacation.
Yeah, me too.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. By the time we sold our home, we were paying like 1/6 of our income, and that was our net. 1/6 of our net for our mortgage payment.
That's great.
Yeah. And so yeah, because the same thing. It's like I don't want to be house poor. I would rather live in a smaller home and be able to do all the things I want to do and not be house poor.
I love this idea of stability, you know, and Jason talking about you also need a kitty of money, because when you move into the house, you're immediately going to want to re-landscape mm-hmm. it. You're going to want to put new furniture in it. You've got all these expenses. You know, every time I've moved, the people at Home Depot know my name for the next 3 weeks, right?
Right.
I wish I was getting like frequent flyer miles from them. So this stability idea, I mean, I'm 47 years old and I have listeners write to me, tell me they think I'm still unstable. So what do you do that?
Well, you know, there's emotionally unstable and financially
that's
unstable.
That's a different show, Joe.
Oh. Ambiguity.
Do you think there's anything else that the listeners should think about before jumping in to buying a house?
I think there's one, which is I think this topic confuses people because they think they hear real estate and they think good investment, right? We see the Property Brothers. I mean, that's my wife's favorite show. So you see the Property Show. Do we love it or do we list it? Yeah. Yeah. Shows like that, which make it very, the real estate game very sexy, and real estate can be. And I don't think we can draw a big enough line between real estate as investment and real estate as the house you live in are two completely different topics. In fact, I was just at the REIT.com, which is the National Association of Real Estate Professionals, I believe. And And I looked up the North American REIT index statistics, and real estate has some great returns, but none of the people, a REIT is something totally different than a place that you live. So when I've said before that the two types of investments that kick inflation's butt, which you really need in your portfolio, I think are stocks and real estate, I'm definitely not talking about the house you live in. The house you live in is more like what Jason talked about. Real estate just keeps up with inflation. It just motors along at a 3% return.
Right.
Well, this is another, you know, area we haven't talked about is location. We've talked about location as far as, you know, if you're in a hot market or you're not in a hot market. But what about those locations that, you know, maybe it's more acreages because it's not a large city and there's less buyers, you know, that how does that impact your deciding factor of rent versus buy, Miranda?
So this is my problem right now. I'm getting ready to move to a new city. And this new city has a terrible rental market in terms of what I want and where I want it and just meeting my needs. And so for about the same monthly payments that I can rent something that I want, I can buy and actually spend less per month buying. And so it's turned into this cash flow thing for me. I know I'll be there for 6 years. And so it's more of a monthly cash flow thing. Plus, once again, it goes back to my lifestyle. What do I want? And so I can actually find something in a small little HOA community where they'll take care of my yard and my snow shoveling, which are things that I hate. And I can buy something in this little community, and it's not as great as renting, and I would rather rent, but looking at the market and the realities of the situation, I'm kind of resigned.
Wow. Okay.
Joe, your thoughts on physical location?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult, and I made a decision that was actually anti what I would probably tell my clients to do, because we bought a house in a very small city in the middle of nowhere. We live in Texarkana, Texas, right on the Texas Arkansas border, and we bought a house that is a Faye Jones protege house, and Faye Jones is, you know, people that don't know architecture a lot look at my house and they think it looks like Frank Lloyd Wright. So I own a Frank Lloyd Wright looking house in a town of 60,000 people that seriously don't understand this kind of architecture. So I'm looking at this thing when I'm ready to sell, it's going to be on the market for a long time because it's going to take a person like me that wants to own that type of house. But you know, we were making a long-term lifestyle decision. I wasn't making a short-term decision, and I got a monster discount that we can save for a different show on the property, partly because of that, some of those factors. But I think you have to look. Man, if you're in a little town like I am, I never understand why somebody buys a house on a major road or a house next to railroad tracks. When there's so many houses that aren't in those spots, because you're immediately going to get rid of a bunch of potential buyers when you're ready to sell. And I think that's probably the best advice I could give anyone is when you're buying a house, think of it as if you're ready to sell. How easy is it going to be for this house to sell? For me, I knew when we moved into this house that it was going to be difficult to sell, but I also knew that the price was way, way, way below what it had been a year earlier when they had originally put it on the market. And then I even looked for a much deeper discount and I was able to get it.
Okay, but nice. Here's a question. When you turn around knowing it's going to be harder to sell, are you going to be in the same position where you have to lower the price?
Well, that's interesting. Maybe. However, seeing that I absolutely love where I live and I want to be here forever. I mean, that was my goal when we bought it, that you know, theoretically, my kids are going to have to maybe lower the price after I pass away, because I want to be here for a long time.
Okay.
And I think that makes the most amount of sense. That goes back to what is your lifestyle? What are your preferences? What can you do in that location and how long, you know, will you be there? And what are the realities of that location?
Mm-hmm. All right. Anybody have any parting thoughts?
That was it.
Chirp, chirp, chirp. All right. that brings to conclusion another episode. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. If you have any questions, comments, anything you want answered, we would love to hear from you. You can either come find us at moneytreepodcast.com or head on over to iTunes and leave us a note over there. Your ratings and reviews help us get found by more people, so we would appreciate them. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.